1492, Columbus discovered America. Many people believe that his first contact was with the Indians. Well, that isn't quite true. In fact, a very bizarre and never revealed story did, in fact, occur. While Columbus and his men disembarked from the Mayflower and the Santa Maria, Zechariah, Columbus's book boy, wrote in his diary, which he kept in his pillow, he said, "A warning came from the beachhead. It was heard all throughout the area. Here comes the colonel. Here comes the colonel."
Oh, yeah, funny guys, funny guys. Give me an introduction from dear old Uncle Walter. Sure. Well, welcome back. It's the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. In just a minute, we're going to have Jim Morris back again, professor of electrical and computer engineering at Portland State University. And he's telling us all about the exciting things that are going on with the 11th International Conference on Nanotechnology, August 15th, 18th, this summer in Portland, at the Portland Marriott Downtown Hotel. Now, if you want to know more about this, it's really easy to do. Go to our website, and that's promiseoftomorrow.biz, promiseoftomorrow.biz, and look at the right-hand side of the screen, and you're going to see a link to the 11th International Conference on Nanotechnology. This is the flagship IEEE Conference on Nanotechnology. It moves all around the world, and Dr. Morris is telling us all about the history of it. He did it in the first half of the program. Been in Korea, been in a lot of really, really different places. So many fields of electronic materials, photonics, bio and medical devices, alternative energy, all sorts of different things, and a lot of noted speakers. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments are the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set for today's mysterious query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Okay, oh spirit of the fountain, are you ready for today's mind-twisting question? All right, here it is. As a matter of fact, this is an easy one. What Atlanta-born Nobel Prize winner was jailed 14 times during his 39 years on Earth? There's two clues there for you. 39 years on Earth and jailed 14 times, and an Atlanta Nobel Prize winner. Anyway, who was it?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell me.
I can't fool you, and probably nobody in the audience either. The Atlanta-born Nobel Prize winner, jailed 14 times during his 39 years on this earth, Martin Luther King Jr. Yes, of course, you are correct. Martin Luther King Jr. All right. Okay, we'll get back to our guest in just a minute. But before we do, I guess you probably noticed there's no commercials on this program. And that's not always been the case. You know, for the first couple of years that we were on the air, the program was loaded with commercials. But we decided to go commercial-free now about, a year and a half ago, I guess. Anyway, we still can't help but notice the obnoxious commercials that are on the air. And once in a while, it might be kind of fun to point them out here on this program. There's one particularly that really gets under my skin, and that's the one for Niaspan. I mean, you know, first of all, there's the setup.
This intervention brought to you by Niaspan.
Okay, now they've done that. They have a fictional situation where a younger brother is lecturing his older brother. But what it really is the producers of Niaspan lecturing you and me, and I really resent it.
Yeah, it's me, big brother. Put the remote down and listen. You told me your doctor's worried about plaque clogging your arteries. That cholesterol medicine he also wants you on? Niaspan? Hey, Pete, you waiting for an engraved invitation?
You know, how we'd like to see that commercial really done. We'd like the brother to answer and explain why he's not taking this garbage. Like, wise up, little brother.
Niaspan is not for everyone. Like people with stomach ulcers, liver, or serious bleeding problems. Severe liver damage can occur when switching to Niaspan from immediate-release niacin. If you have muscle pain or weakness, sign of serious side effects. This risk can increase with statin use. Flushing, a common side effect, is warmth, redness, itching, or tingling of the skin.
And so, little brother, that's the reason I don't take this nasty stuff, so just butt out and mind your own business. Well, that's the way we'd kind of like to see the commercial go. Anyway, if you have a favorite commercial you'd like us to feature in this program and make fun of, just let us know here at the studio. All right. So you can be sure, as these commercial people try to get on our show, we're going to fight them all the way. We're not going to let a single commercial on this broadcast ever again.
Wonder where the Durango's been for the last 2 years?
No! No, I don't! Get out of here! Go away! Okay, now back to today's very interesting guest, Jim Morris, professor of electrical and computer engineering, Portland State University, one of the principal organizers of the 11th International Conference on Nanotechnology, which is shaping up to be a very, very, very exciting event. There's a lot of exciting things going with it, the biomedical devices, multiple areas of current and future electrical and electronics applications. Robert Chow of Intel Corporation is going to be there to speak. But let's right now get back to Dr. Morris. Who are some of the other speakers that you're going to be having at the event?
Well, too many to mention by name, of course, with the technical sessions. I think we've covered, actually, everyone on the invited speakers.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention, though, invited speakers, that's the wrong term, and the keynote speakers. Each of those 60 sessions will also lead off with an invited talk. But the invitations, the identification of the appropriate invited speakers for the technical sessions are up to the track committee chairs. I should mention that in the organization, we have two program co-chairs. It's Chris Bailey from University of Greenwich in England, in London, and Pabas Famuri from West Virginia University. They've been doing a fantastic job in bringing in the and organizing the technical committees, because we have under them 22 tracks of each different area, and those 22 tracks each have two co-chairs. For the most part, those co-chairs are someone with an ongoing relationship with the Nanotechnology Council, and someone more regional, someone more local. That's not 100% the case across all of them, but that's the general pattern. So those two co-chairs for each track, in many cases, have gone out soliciting papers from their individual community, and then, of course, they have a committee, in some cases a large committee, in some cases a smaller one, which then reviews the abstracts which have come in. And those track co-chairs are also responsible for inviting the individual invited papers that will lead off each session.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those papers, the idea is that while they may be presenting their own work, they'll also provide some background to the general session area so that there is a context, effectively.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed that Intel Corporation is a major sponsor of the event, and Robert Chow, a senior fellow there at Intel, is going to be speaking. We've invited him to come on the program and talk to us, but I understand that Intel's a little reluctant to let their people come on and subject themselves to the press. But can you give us kind of a preview of what Chow is going to be talking about?
I don't know in detail. I'm hoping that he will be, broadly, I believe that he'll be talking about the development of nanotechnology in Intel devices. And, of course, Intel has just made the announcement that they're going with a FinFET structure for the next generation. And, of course, FinFETs have been talked about for a while. There's been a number of papers around, so it's no secret that Intel has been interested in this area, but I would anticipate there'd be some more detailed background to that development, and hopefully a context of other research. I've heard Robert speak in the past about indium antimonide, for example, as a new material as nanotechnology shrinks further down. I know that I've heard of, in fact, from him and his co-workers, I've seen presentations which have included Intel work on carbon nanotubes. Whether or not he will get into these, I really can't say at this point.
Well, I see at the website that it says that he's going to be speaking on transistor research and nanotechnology, so that kind of fits in with what you were saying there just a minute ago. And, of course, a lot of people are saying, well, gee whiz, you know, the show is really very heavy on electronics into it. But actually, Rachel Smith is going to speak on molecular and cell biology, I understand. She's a staff scientist at Life Technologies. We're trying to get Rachel on this program to find out what she's talking about, but I haven't heard back from her yet. But we'll certainly let you know when we're able to finally connect with her.
Okay, and my background, of course, is in the nanoelectronics side. I'm speaking from a position of total ignorance anytime I say anything on the bio side, so I'm probably best not to say anything because I'm sure to get it wrong. But actually, while the nanoelectronics may be one of the more obvious areas, and in fact it's split into a number of different tracks, it is dominated in the past, and so this time we felt that it was too much of a load for one committee to handle, and so we've really sort of split it into devices, which would include single electron transistors, MEM resistors, and resonant tunnel diodes, other such active devices. And there is a separate track for carbon nanotubes and graphene and nanowires, which is sort of, there's a crossover between nanowires and carbon nanotubes and between carbon nanotubes and graphene, and so we've put those all in together. So that's the largest single track in the nanoelectronics area. But also there is a lot developing now in architectures. How do you design systems for nano devices, in many cases fault tolerant, and how do you organize all of this into a system? And that's actually got more sessions than I had thought it would. I think there's about three. And then there's another one on reliability and yield. And so the nanoelectronics got split up. So now it turns out that the largest single track is nanomaterials. And of course, again, there's a crossover into other overlaps into other areas. But the nanomaterials track will have a session in each time slot. It's the largest single track.
Well, you mentioned graphene, and of course, Alex Balandon, the University of California at Riverside, when he was on the program recently, gave us a really thorough briefing on what's going on with graphene and the things that that he's doing in that area. Absolutely fascinating to see that happen. And of course, when you mentioned about materials and electronics, that's the logical first steps, I think, for the nanotechnology revolution. I mean, it was the easiest area to go in, the place where there was a lot of commercial demand and that sort of thing. And of course, biology and the cell biology platforms for nanotechnology, a lot of that is slow to commercial because it's getting approval from the Food and Drug Administration just to operate in that realm. But you remember Rick Smalley, the late Rick Smalley of Rice University, who led the team that discovered the Buckyball in 1985 and won the Nobel Prize. He separated the two thoughts of nanotechnology into what he called the dry and the wet. And you work in the dry, and of course Rachel Smith works in the wet.
That's an interesting terminology. I haven't heard that before, but it's very appropriate, yes.
Yeah, I would say so. Well, Dr. Boris, what are some of the other outstanding things that we haven't talked about that you want to be sure and get in today before we draw this to a close?
Well, I think the main thing is that hasn't been mentioned is off the conference, the tourist potential for people who are thinking of coming. Don't just come for the conference. Spend an extra couple of days and enjoy some of the attractions that Oregon has to offer. And, of course, much of that is the great outdoors and the fabulous scenery of the coast and the valleys and the Cascades Range and so on. Mount Hood, for example, is very close by. The other thing is I find that most of my European colleagues, when they come and visit, the thing that they want to do is go to Mount St. Helens, mm-hmm. which people don't always realize is relatively close by. And, in fact, Portland received most of the more of the fallout of that more than any other city because of its proximity. It's the closest major city, of course, to Mount St. Helens. The other thing, of course, is I have to mention that Portland has a reputation of being America's microbrewery capital, and in addition, there are just one of the best wine-growing areas in the country, in my opinion. I'm sorry, I may be losing California en masse at this point, but... the Oregon Pinot wineries are just superb, and so people really should take advantage of the time that they're here and take in whatever of those attractions most appeal.
I had forgotten all about Mount St. Helens, and actually that's right. That's right there in the vicinity, and I can imagine a lot of scientists might want to get out there and see it. For those too young to know what we're speaking about, Mount St. Helens was a sleepy mountain for a long time until it finally blew up into an enormous volcano, and it seems to me that it was about 30 years ago when that happens. I was in St. Louis at the time, and I remember the ash cloud drifting all the way from Oregon across the Rockies, and for days there was an ash cloud going over top of us in St. Louis, Missouri, and it blew away the entire side of the mountain, killed a lot of people and wildlife, but I understand that the ecosystem there is coming back. Could you fill us in on what we would see if we went to Mount St. Helens?
I don't know too much about it, but of course it rumbles every now and again, and in fact relatively recently, there were concerns it did erupt, but not on the scale that it did before. And so there was a dome forming in the crater, and that was being watched fairly closely. And as I say, with the rumbling, they essentially closed things off and limited tourist access and so on, so that many roads were closed off and one couldn't get... too close. And of course, it's monitored fairly extensively by the local geology community and so on. So I have to confess, it's one of the things that's still on my list of things to do since I've been here. I'm reminded of my daughter living in New York City, who said that one of the reasons that she loved being in New York City because of all the things to do with the Statue of Liberty, for example, and so on. And so when she left, I asked her how many of the things that she had done, and you never go to the attractions where you live.
Yeah.
So maybe this summer or next summer I'll actually get to Mount St. Helens myself.
Yeah, I understand about that. I live in Dallas, and I've never been to the sixth-floor museum where Oswald was said to have shot President Kennedy. And Mount St. Helens with that ash cloud reminds me that when that ash cloud drifted across the United States, there were a lot of illnesses from breathing in the ash, and the longest word, I'm told, in the English language was coined at that particular time to describe the affliction of breathing in the ash from Mount St. Helens, and it was called Newman Ultra Microscopic Silico-Vulcanon Conatosis. And at one time, I could even spell it.
That I haven't heard. I always thought that the longest word was Well, actually, the longest place name was supposed to be somewhere in Wales, except I think there is someone in, somewhere in New Zealand, which is where I originally come from. It actually has the longest place name in the world, but don't ask me to come up with what it actually is now. What, again, at one stage, I probably could have told you, but not anymore.
Well, if you're from New Zealand, you're a countryman of a very, very good friend of mine, the late Alan McDiarmid, Nobel laureate from New Zealand. You probably know exactly whom I'm speaking about. He was very active in nanotechnology.
Yes, and the McDiarmid Institute there, in fact, is a multi-university research organization which supports funding for much of the nanotechnology research in New Zealand. And in particular, there are two universities, Victoria University in Wellington and the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, where the earthquake was, are major participants in the institute, along with what was the government research organization.
Alan McDiarmid was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person to know. His death was a big loss to us all. The Nanotechnology Institute at the University of Texas at Dallas is named after him and run by my good friend Ray Bachman. I don't know if you know Ray or not, but it was really, really quite an organization.
No, I don't know him, but I did stumble across the fact that there was more than one McDiarmid Institute when I saw that one as well. And I guess that I really became more familiar with the one in New Zealand when I was on sabbatical and spent 6 weeks at the university in Christchurch a couple of years ago.
Well, the those who want to know more about the 11th International Conference on Nanotechnology need only go to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz, and there on the right-hand side of the screen will be a link, and they'll be able to go to your website and read all about the things that are going on and register to attend the conference or make plans to exhibit or sponsor the conference. I understand there's still some exhibit spaces open, some conference spaces open also. And you've just been wonderful to have with us today, Jim. So kind of you with taking your valuable time. I know you've got to get away here in a little bit to go to another meeting. Is there anything we need to cover before we say goodbye?
No, I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to speak to everyone.
And now we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
One thing, we have these discussions, and, you know, the National Lab researchers, we tend to come across as terribly negative people, but I like to remind people at the end, when we're done with all this, that, you know, the situation for the U.S. is really good. It's really optimistic. I lived in Germany 4 or 5 years. That's before I came to this job 7 years ago. And, you know, in Europe, they face many fundamental problems we don't face. We have good supplies of oil. We have almost unlimited coal. We have tar sands, shale oil. We have, it looks like maybe 300 years worth of natural gas. We have biopotential. We have solar. We have wind. You know, everything when you look at the U.S. situation is really upbeat. The only down part of it is the fact that we don't use all these phenomenal resources that we have for transportation. All we use is oil. So the real upside of this whole thing is our outlook is good no matter which path technology takes, because the U.S. can just about do anything that we need to do. And I want to always remind people that our outlook is fantastic, and we just need to go and grasp it. This is Don Hillebrand. I'm the Director of Transportation Research at Argonne National Laboratory.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
You will be there. I am waiting for you. I seeds for you.